Good evening. The House of Lords says no to Boris Johnson, and one of the most consequential leaders in African history dies.
I return to freedom for our people. An environment in which our people will be free.
And what's killing the vapors? With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the WBAI Evening News for Friday, September 6th, 2019. Britain's House of Lords endorsed a measure Friday that would block Prime Minister Boris Johnson's plan to leave the European Union next month without a deal in place, giving final approval to a bill the House of Commons passed earlier this week.
We have heard many concerns raised with this bill, but more fundamentally, the issues at play here are not just technical. It is about seriously undermining negotiations that could achieve a deal before the 31st of October, frustrating the referendum result and stopping Brexit.
This bill do now pass. As many of that opinion will say, content.
Content!
The contrary not content, the contents have it.
The House of Lords passage was widely expected after the bill got overwhelming support in the House of Commons on Wednesday. The legislation now proceeds to royal assent, a formality that will result in it becoming law. The legislation would force Johnson to formally ask the European Union to extend the Brexit deadline through next January if a new withdrawal deal is not agreed upon by October 19th. The current Brexit deadline is October 31st. And in the United States, a Virginia court ruled Wednesday the U.S. government's list of known or suspected terrorists violates the constitutional due process rights of the million-plus people on it, but the government insists the case doesn't belong in court at all. Eastern District of Virginia Judge Anthony Trenga ruled the watch list is too vague to risk depriving Americans of what he called their travel-related and reputational liberty interests. The suit was argued by CARE, the Council of American Islamic Relations. The judge ordered both CARE and the federal government to make recommendations on a remedy. Carolyn Homer is a trial attorney for CARE.
The Federal Terrorist Watch List is a database that was established by the FBI in 2003. And this database purports to compile a list of who the FBI considers to be known or suspected terrorists. And the criteria to be designated as a suspected terrorist are exceptionally vague and can include things like having family in the Middle East, learning Arabic, being Muslim, attending a mosque with somebody else the FBI thinks might be a terrorist. And so for the last 15 years, civil rights organizations, including CARE, have been challenging this list and the constitutionality of it in federal courts. And on Wednesday, the Eastern District of Virginia issued the most sweeping ruling against the watch list in American history.
What did that ruling say?
Primarily two things. It said, first, that the criteria to put individuals on this watch list were unconstitutionally vague and meaningless, that essentially the FBI had given itself full authority based on subjective assumptions about individuals to designate them as suspected terrorists. And then the next thing it held was that the consequences of being on this watch list are severe. It leads to difficulties traveling, crossing borders. You can be separated from your family. You can be denied employment. You can be harassed and arrested and detained at gunpoint. Your electronic devices are searched every time you cross a border. And that this impinges upon constitutional liberty interests. And then finally, the judge said that individuals who are on the watch list are given no notice that they are added to the watch list and no reason for being added to the watch list and no meaningful opportunity to challenge being on the watch list, and that that violates the due process of law.
So what happens now? Is the watch list suspended? Is it still in effect? Is there something new that's going to replace it?
The judge withheld that question for now. He asked the government and the CARE attorneys to submit supplemental briefs in 30 days about what should happen now. CARE's position is going to be that, as presently constituted, the watch list should not exist, that any innocent American should not be on the watch list, that the criteria is so vague as to make the list completely impossible, and that certainly notice should be provided, an opportunity to challenge, even for all individuals who have ever been on and are currently on this list.
The air traffic system is dominated by the United States, yet it affects many different countries. You talk about airports. This could affect people traveling in other countries as well who use the same list as the United States.
It was revealed in this case that the United States shares this list with more than 60 foreign countries. And we certainly know that this includes being shared with airports. Individuals on this list are often prohibited from, even if they're American citizens, they're often prohibited from boarding a flight in a foreign airport that is then traveling to the United States.
Now, there were many stories over the years of people who were being put on for reasons they didn't know. There was no connection at all to anything that would be remotely terrorist, and yet they had a hard time getting their names off. Is that still a problem?
Absolutely. So CARE currently represents more than 100 Muslim Americans who are on the list, or that we believe are on the list, based on how they're treated by the United States government. And these are individuals who have committed no wrongdoing, who have no idea why they're on. And as far as we can tell, the only reason they've ended up on the list is because of targeted FBI suspicion against the Muslim American community.
And there also could be name, like if a name is similar to another name. I've heard stories where people were stopped.
That's one of the most common problems, is that if your name is similar to other individuals or spelled similarly, that the FBI's approach is to flag you now and ask questions later.
Now, recently, there was a student going to Harvard who was stopped at the airport and sent back home, and now he finally got to start school. But was that one of these cases?
We don't have enough information about whether or not that was a watchlist case or whether it was a Muslim ban case. There's certainly several reasons why Customs and Border Protection turn people away at the border, but it is entirely possible that it could be a watchlist case. Just famously, several years ago, there was a student at Stanford her name was Ibrahim, who traveled to Indonesia for a conference and then was blocked from coming back to the United States because she was added to the watch list. And it was later revealed that the FBI had literally checked the wrong box and they had meant to not add her to the watch list, but she ended up being banned from the country for more than a decade.
Why is it so difficult to fix it if there's a mistake?
The reason it's so difficult is because the government doesn't really acknowledge that the watch list exists or that any individual is on it. The government's position in dozens of cases across the country is that it violates national security to either confirm or deny that any individual is on the list or any details about how you get on the list. And that's what this judge on Wednesday identified as a problem.
Does this have anything to do with the Muslim ban? Is this connected to that at all?
We have not seen a formal, like, administrative process connection, but certainly it has to do with the broad culture of Islamophobia within the U.S. government, within the counterterrorism community.
And Carolyn Homer is a trial attorney for the Council of American Islamic Relations. The terrorist screening database, as it is officially called, has exploded in size since the creation of a special FBI department to house it in 2003, numbering about 1.2 million people as of 2017. Beyond airport screenings and citizenship evaluations, the watch list is used to run driver's licenses in traffic stops, to determine whether a municipal permit should be awarded, and to conduct background checks for firearm sales. And the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, on Friday discouraged people from using e-cigarettes as it investigates 450 possible cases of lung disease linked to vaping, more than double the number of cases from last week. Indiana reported its first vaping-related death Friday, following similar fatalities in Illinois and Oregon. Officials say it's unclear what's causing the illnesses, but many cases appear to involve vape products containing THC, a compound found in marijuana. Some patients also reported using nicotine vapes. New York State health officials on Thursday reported that nearly all the vape products that it has tested containing THC also contain vitamin E acetate, an oil-like substance that can be harmful if inhaled. But federal officials on Friday cautioned that vitamin E is one piece of the puzzle. Paul Stanford is a licensed marijuana grower in Oregon who's been vaping pot for more than 20 years. He's the founder of the Campaign for the Restoration and Regulation of Hemp, and he says the problem isn't the pot, but the unregulated ingredients in the vaping oils.
Vaping is the pre-combustion heating of a material so that it turns into vapor, you know. So you take a material and say generally combustion's at 452 degrees Fahrenheit. And so you heat it up below that. A lot of these vape pens, they heat it up a little too high, and therefore it burns and causes some combustion or smoke. But the main culprit here, there are two main culprits in problems with vaping. One is the adulterants in the vape fluid. So they will use often another material to make a more viscous or thicker liquid, more liquid, so it'll flow and flow into the heating element inside the vapor pin. And so a lot of times they'll use propylene glycol. And I think they are saying that the deaths are attributed to a soy-based additive that was put in. That's the latest rumor in the rumor mill anyway. Some of the deaths, and one here in Oregon where I live specifically, was based to a soy-based carrier carrying a marijuana byproduct. But a lot of different vape manufacturers use different carriers. In the marijuana industry, some of them are using aromatic hydrocarbons from plants that are called terpenes. There are hundreds of different terpenes that cause flavors and smells, such as lime and strawberries. Different terpenes cause these aromas. Some manufacturers are adding those terpenes back in as a carrier agent. The people who are buying these things have to pay very close attention to the manufacturer. And another issue is heavy metals and metal contamination in some of the products as well. It's best to know what those additives are and what their long-term health effects are yet to be fully understood.
And what is it that the marijuana industry and people who are friendly to marijuana, a lot of people have been vaping. Vaping is a way easier way of doing it than smoking for a lot of people. Especially what's interesting is that vaping was taken up by people who were worried about the health problems of smoking burnt matter, you know, in the form of smoking marijuana in a joint. Is this a new problem, or is it as widespread as they're saying, or is it something how can we solve it?
Well, I think vaping is a better alternative for inhalation of a substance, because usually in the burning process, the majority of the substance that the person's trying to take in is destroyed. And what's actually ingested or inhaled are combustion byproducts like tar and carbon monoxide and a lot of other things that plant matter or oils turn into when they are burned. I personally have been vaporizing for almost 20 years with a heat method that just puts heat onto herb and extracts the vapor. And I had been a smoker of cannabis for about 20 years before that, maybe longer, more like 25 years. When I switched to vaporization, I had a smoker's hack cough. That all went away. But the main culprit in the vape pen system is the additives are the real hazards here.
You're suggesting that a better alternative is, rather than vaping these oils and using these pen systems as convenient as they are, that a system where you actually put the marijuana in a container that heats it within the container, the actual, you know, powdered or bud, and heats it to the right temperature and then creates the...
That's vastly superior, because you don't have the added carrier agents nor the heavy metals involved in some of the manufacturing. You know, most of these things are manufactured. The things that hold the vapor liquid, most of those are manufactured overseas. I prefer that myself.
In the media, you see the anti-marijuana people are jumping right into this feet first, showing, looking, you know, desperately for a negative story about marijuana on the health front. And they've been, you know, been saying it's too strong, it's too this, but they never really could say it hurt anybody or anybody died till now. Is that a problem for the marijuana legalization movement?
I don't really think so. We can look also at the recent publicity about youth use of Juuls and other vaporizers as well. These products are new, and I think just directly vaporizing the material is a better alternative. But they're not as convenient, as we just have to know the manufacturer and what they're doing and ask for more transparency in that, I believe. But I think it's odd that these groups try to say that this other process is makes marijuana bad. This isn't really caused by the marijuana. It's caused by the carrier. And it's better generally than smoking. And it should be investigated and find what the real culprit is. But it's hyperbole, I believe, really.
Paul Stanford is a licensed marijuana grower in Oregon who's been vaping pot for more than 20 years. And in breaking vape news, Minnesota health officials announced a death in their state of someone who had a history of underlying lung disease in August. After the patient died, investigators linked the lung injury to vaping illicit THC products. Another potential vaping-related death was reported in Los Angeles County, according to an announcement by the LA County Department of Public Health. And you're listening to the news on WBAI Pacifica Radio in New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg has made a flurry of public appearances in the past few weeks amid concerns over her health. The Supreme Court announced in August that Ginsburg had undergone 3 weeks of radiation treatment for a malignant tumor on her pancreas, saying that she tolerated the treatment well. 3 days after the announcement, Ginsburg visited the University of Buffalo in New York on August 26th to receive an honorary law degree.
First, this audience can see that I am alive. And I am on my way to being very well.
Conspiracy theorists linked to the pro-Trump QAnon movement have been saying she's already dead. While her public appearances may not sway their opinions, the notorious RBG appeared Tuesday in Little Rock, Arkansas, where she again emphasized her good health. Former Judge Bill Blum wrote an article for TruthDig.com titled, "If Ruth Bader Ginsburg Can't Hold On." He tells WBAI that the Trump administration has been very busy stuffing the courts with right-wingers, and the future of the court is at stake.
Depends on whether or not any of the present justices step down. And we have Justice Ginsburg, who's recovering from her fourth bout of cancer. She'll be 87 in March. We have Stephen Breyer, who just celebrated his 81st birthday. So they are the two oldest, and they're both Democrats. If Trump were to get one, or if two more appointments to the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court, from a progressive standpoint, would be lost to the country for a generation, barring some sweeping changes along the lines of expanding the number of justices. You would have far more right-wing justices on the bench, Federalist Society people, and the outlook of the court, both philosophically and politically, would be dramatically altered.
Does Donald Trump really have the power to continue appointing new judges? I mean, even with a majority in the House,
has nothing to do with the confirmation process. So it's all about the president and the Senate as set out in the Constitution, and there is no filibuster for judges or justices of the Supreme Court anymore. So this all depends on the next election and on, as far as the Supreme Court goes, the justices holding on and continuing to serve beyond the election. And if a Democratic president is inaugurated, then we'll have a different situation. In the meantime, Trump is appointing all sorts of judges to the district court, courts in the United States and to the federal courts of appeals.
Why can't we say, well, maybe next president will be a Democrat, Joe Biden or Elizabeth Warren or someone along those lines, and they'll just undo it? Why can't we just say that?
The judicial appointments under the Constitution are for life, and they can be removed only for good cause. You could conceivably impeach judges. The only people who have been impeached and removed from office in our history have been judges. There have been 8 federal judges who have been impeached and removed. So that's possible, but you generally don't impeach people just for policy differences. You'd have to have some sort of violation of the public trust. There has been talk about Clarence Thomas and how he has not been truthful in his financial disclosures, and that is something that could rise to the level of an impeachable offense. But, of course, we don't have a Democratic Senate. And, of course, to impeach, you need a two-thirds. To impeach and remove, you need a two-thirds vote in the Senate. You know, impeachment begins in the House with an article of impeachment that's passed by a majority, goes on to the Senate, and then there's a trial of sorts, and you must have a vote of two-thirds of the Senate, which sits as the jury, in order to remove someone from office. So another plan is to expand the number of justices on the Supreme Court, which could be done. We haven't always been a 9-court Supreme Court. At the end of the Civil War, we had 10 people on the court. We began this republic with 6 members on the court. And that is something that Congress can do. You don't need a constitutional amendment to do it. Of course, FDR toyed with that, more than toyed. He threatened to do it. And the court, largely in response to that threat, changed its position on New Deal legislation. And then the idea of packing the court receded as a political issue. But that remains an option. And we are in new territory now with Donald Trump at the helm. Now, I don't credit Trump with picking these judges or justices. This is largely done by the Federalist Society, the Heritage Foundation, and other right-wing organizations and smart people on the political right. And Trump goes along with that. And, of course, that's one of the ways that he maintains his Republican support. They tolerate his tweets, his weather maps, and everything else, as long as he delivers the tax breaks that they crave and the sorts of judges that they want.
What are we facing right now? I mean, progressives and progressive agendas in this country.
On the left, we really have to start taking the courts extremely seriously. If you think about the Trump era so far, what has stopped Trump from becoming an outright tyrant? It's been the courts. So we need to take the courts seriously, starting with the Supreme Court. And we have to understand the importance of someone like Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Former Judge Bill Blum wrote an article for TruthDig.com titled, "If Ruth Bader Ginsburg Can't Hold On." And Robert Mugabe, the first prime minister and later president of independent Zimbabwe, died on Friday in Singapore at the age of 95. In 1963, he founded ZANU, a resistance movement against British colonial rule.
Our return to freedom for our people, an environment in which our people will be free.
International perception of him significantly declined in his final years. Admired as a champion of Africa's independence struggle, his long rule descended into allegations of tyranny, corruption, and incompetence as Zimbabwe's economy collapsed. But despite his long tenure, Mugabe will be remembered as a liberator who just didn't know when to leave. Milton Alamadi has this commentary on the colorful and enigmatic rule of Robert Mugabe.
Former Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe, who has died at age 95, was one of the great heroes of African liberation. He was also one of the most intelligent and articulate leaders. His legacy will be a mixed one because he clung on to power for too long. When he was in prison in the 1960s in white-ruled Rhodesia, Mugabe earned multiple degrees through correspondence courses. In exile, his Zimbabwe African National Union, ZANU, teamed up with Joshua Nkomo's Zimbabwe African People's Union, ZAPU, as the patriotic front to fight against the white minority regime in Rhodesia. After Britain organized independence talks at Lancaster House in the UK, Mugabe won elections in 1980. After a falling out between Mugabe and Nkomo, Mugabe unleashed the army on Nkomo's stronghold of Matabeleland region. Thousands of civilians were massacred. This episode tarnished Mugabe's reputation to many Pan-Africans. In 1997, Tony Blair withdrew British financial support to Zimbabwe for buying back land from white farmers to distribute to Africans. Mugabe told the British Prime Minister that his government could not justify paying white settlers with his own funds for land that their ancestors stole when the country was colonized in the 19th century. People started forcefully seizing the land. Some white farmers were killed. Britain, the US, and the EU imposed debilitating sanctions on Zimbabwe. Land remains a toxic issue in Southern Africa. In South Africa, for example, 25 years after the end of apartheid, whites who make up less than 10% of the population own 72% of private farmland. During a UN speech, Mugabe famously declared, "We are not Europeans. We have not asked for an inch of Europe, any square inch of that territory. So Blair, keep your England and let me keep my Zimbabwe." Back home, however, sanctions took its toll. Hyperinflation destroyed the national currency. By 2015, Zimbabwe was using the US dollar as currency. Mugabe was increasingly violent toward opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai. Mugabe's much younger wife, Grace Mugabe, wanted to succeed him. There were reports that she poisoned Vice President Emmerson Mnangagwa. He survived. The military sided with Mnangagwa and eased Mugabe out of power. By wielding power for 37 years, many Zimbabweans who came of age at a later stage will associate the country's economic demise as Mugabe's legacy. But whenever they till the soil or bury their loved ones, millions more will remember the return of the land to Africans. Ironically, Mugabe's death may now pave the way for the lifting of Western sanctions, something which Zimbabwe badly needs to restore its economy. Africa is not yet Uhuru. This is Milton Alimadi, Black Star News. This is commercial free, listener supported, WBAI, New York.
And that's some of the news for Friday, September 6, 2019. The news was produced with Linda Perry and Oliver Sampson. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.